Hello and welcome to The Thing About Cars. It's a beautiful day here in Atlanta, and I'm presuming in the Netherlands because Misty's there. Around the table, we've got Dave. How are you?
I am well. Thanks, Mickey.
Excellent. Misty, how are you?
I'm wet. It's raining.
Ben, how's it going, Ben?
Oh, it's going great. How about you?
It's fantastic here. And our guest for the day is the one, the only Dean Case with Motiva and SAE. Dean, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great this morning.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. And let's do our grand trivia auto question real quick. I believe this one was sent to us from Tim. And the question is, Chrysler built more than 12.5 million slant sixes from 1959 to 1991, which is a surprise to me. I didn't know Chrysler was still doing slant sixes in 1991. Anyway, Chrysler built more than 12.5 million slant sixes from 1959 to 1991. These inline six-cylinder engines are known for being reliable and sensible. However, nearly 50,000 futuristic slant sixes were installed in 1961 to 62 Valiants and Lancers. What made that batch of slant sixes so unique? And the potential answers are, they had an aluminum engine block, or choice B, they had an electric-assisted supercharger, or choice C, they had two spark plugs per cylinder. And then D, of course, is all of the above. And I believe this question comes to us from our trivia czar, Tim, I think. We'll have to double check that with Tim because his name is not on this, but he may have sent. So do I need to read those again, you guys?
Yeah. Read them again.
Okay, read them again. What made the slant sixes installed in the 61 to 62 Valiants and Lancers so unique? The choices are, obviously, a D, all of the above. C, two spark plugs per cylinder. B, an electric assisted supercharger. Or A, an aluminum engine block. So there's our choices. We'll answer that question at the end of the show. Dean, how's it going and where in the country are you?
I'm in South Torrance, so just about 20 minutes south of LAX.
Okay, on the opposite coast. So it is truly morning for you guys over there. And how did you get into the car business?
Well, I kind of grew up in a car family. My dad was a firefighter, but he had boats and motorcycles and stuff. So I grew up car culture, going to Riverside Raceway and Ascot Park and things like that. So I knew I wanted to get into the automotive industry. And like a lot of people, you end up in engineering because you're good in math and science. So got an engineering degree from Cal Poly. And right place, right time, I got hired in at Mazda R&D in 1986.
I knew Misty was going to light up at that. So what did you do with Mazda R&D in the 90s?
Well, I got hired in 86 and my studio engineer. I wasn't even quite sure what that was going to mean. You know, I was like, I had a vague idea. So I get there the first day and you sign all the HR paperwork and non-disclosure. And they take me back into the studio where there was a full-size clay model of a two-seat sports car that was a couple of years away from production. So I worked on the original Miata. So I had a good time there. You know,
no doubt.
This is one of those unfortunate times where we only record this with audio because Miata Misty is about to fall out.
Oh, if the listeners could see the look on her face.
I'm making noises dogs can hear.
She has not blinked for the last 45 seconds.
Misty drives an MX-5. She named it, affectionately named Claudette. How fast does she go, Misty?
107. Well, I've had her up to 175 kilometers an hour on the Autobahn.
Excellent. Oh.
It's a 2016 Skyactiv G131 GTM.
Okay.
And she was the first in the town I live in, and she's soul red.
And Misty's very, very happy about this conversation today. Misty, do you have any questions for Dean?
You want to come over and ride in my car?
What are the behind the scenes things that you learned about the Miata that the rest of the world may not know?
This is a funny one. It was truly cooked up in a Taco Bell test kitchen. The studio we were in was the former national headquarters of Taco Bell. And so you come in on Monday mornings and the office smelled like taco shells. So, no joke.
And
imagine an office decorated like a 1970s Taco Bell. So it was all browns and golds and yellows and stuff. It was,
nice. It
was wild. They eventually tore that down and built the proper R&D center and everything. But I kind of missed that whole original genre of, you know, in the test kitchen, so to speak. That's
hilarious.
But, you know, I worked with all the original folks who did.
I'm sorry, Dean, go ahead.
You know, all I worked with all the original folks who worked, who developed the car. I mean, I came in late. I joke that I'm one of the only people that worked at Mazda in the 80s who does not claim to be the father of the Miata. You know, you read all these bios of people. It's like, wait a second. They claim that they were the father of the Miata. I don't even remember their name. I would have heard of them if they did something significant. I mean, for the record, I will tell you, I mean, it was a team effort, obviously. And I was a minor player on the team. You know, the father of the Miata was Bob Hall. If it wasn't for Bob, there's a lot of people, Mark Jordan and Wu Hong Chin and Tom Matano and others who did, Norman Garrett, who hired me, you know, layout engineer.
Yep.
No Bob Hall, no Miata.
That's a fair thing to say. No, so yeah. we gotta give proper credit to Bob Hall.
Well, guess who I'm adding to my ancestor shrine. That's exactly gonna happen. No, seriously. I mean, I've had Claudette since February of 2016. It was Valentine's Day present from my husband. And the joke is, because I'm like 5'1", and my husband is 6'9", so guess who doesn't fit in my car?
Yeah.
which is kind of sad, you know, but it's you know, there's a running joke that Claudette is my inanimate best friend.
Well, Misty, all we have to do to get him to fit is to take the seat out.
You know, that actually might work because it's his legs that are the problem. It's his legs that are the problem.
Just give him a little piece of latex to sit on.
Well, I'm sitting in a fourth generation ND passenger seat from an MX-5 here. When we built the race cars, all these were thrown to the scrap. So I have one now as an office chair.
That's awesome.
That is really cool.
Yeah. So I have a side airbag in my office.
Yeah.
Really.
In my office, that would actually deploy.
it actually probably would in mine too.
Just keep the cat away from it.
You know, I love the idea that the Miata was actually cooked up in a Taco Bell kitchen. What was the culture like in that team when you joined it?
It was very small, very personal. I mean, it's kind of funny. Watching reruns of The Office, I realized that I worked with two colleagues who were basically Jim and Pam. You know, it was a great environment, and we had a lot of rotating Japanese staff there. My first boss, his name is Jiro Maebayashi, amazing engineer. He had over 100 design patents, and so, you know, a fantastic experience. And, you know, but it was definitely a small atmosphere. I mean, at our peak, the R&D, 75 people. So you had the design group, the group, and the product plan. We hung out together even on the weekends a lot. So it was there was a lot of us who were a similar age who we'd hired in straight out of school. So, you know, close-knit organization.
So my silly question for the day is, why does it take 75 people to design and engineer a car?
Well, actually, it takes a lot more than that. That's just the advanced design, because we would then, and that's the funny thing. And that's why eventually I left Mazda to go to Ford. Is if you're in an overseas R&D unit, you're just doing bits and pieces of the process. You don't see everything. And so, you know, we were doing support for Japan. You know, that we were the eyes and ears for the North America. You know, you see a lot of cars, whether it was designed for Europe or Japan, fail miserably here, and, you know, U.S. cars, it just don't translate when they get shipped overseas. So you really need to understand the local culture. It's hard to develop any car that's truly global. And if it is global, it's usually a very small niche like the MX-5 Neon.
Interesting.
Well, my question is, and this is something that I've noticed, who was your original target market? Because, like, in the U.S., the Miata is often seen as a girl's car.
That's a great question. Actually, it was seen as a vehicle for all the people who had owned MGs and Lotus, wanted to own a Lotus Elan that had an MG or a Fiat or something, but gave up because they were just unreliable. And, you know, Bob and the team put together a mission statement that there is a great market for a proper two-seat rear-wheel drive sports car that will start every morning. It could be your own.
Oh, yes.
that you could actually have gainful employment because you'd have a reliable car to get to work. And, you know, at that time, a lot of people thought Mazda was crazy because there was no competitor on the market. And you look at all the ones that came in afterwards trying to knock it off that failed. You know, it's funny. It was designed. One of the funniest things I ever saw is someone had a little meme online about stereotypical drivers of who drives the Trans Am with the screaming chicken on the hood, who drives the BMW. And they had the picture of who's the stereotypical driver of the Miata. And someone posted a picture of Jim Clark.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. And that was what we wanted. But obviously we wanted to appeal to women as well. But we wanted enthusiasts, which when the car launched, the first like 6 or 8 months, you could not buy an automatic. It was manual only for the first cars. And that was to make sure that people were buying it who were enthusiasts first. And then the people were looking at it as, you know, shall we say, a fashion statement or more for style than for. And so that was a conscious effort to make sure we got the enthusiasts.
I remember
is a manual.
Yeah.
I won't drive anything else.
I remember the original Road and Track takedown of the original Miata. I was reading Road and Track quite religiously back in those days. And the one thing that somehow sticks in my Swiss cheese brain anymore is the one criticism that the author said about the mirrors. He says the mirrors were too large. And I'm thinking, if that's the worst thing you have to say about a car.
Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to make a confession here because the front is so long. I do use the curves on the front to line up properly sometimes. I'm 5'1". Come on.
Ah, brilliant stuff. Dean, you've got an amazing resume. I mean, it touches Ford, it touches Detroit, it touches Nissan. You've mentioned something here called Project Yellow Light, which sounds just totally secretive and mysterious to me. But I'm hoping, I mean, because we're running out of time, I'm hoping you'll come back and we can talk some more about your history and your experiences in the industry. Can we quickly touch on what Project Yellow Light is, just because my curiosity is way too peaked at this point?
Just Project Yellow Light is a program I partnered my second go around with Mazda and Motorsports more recent years. We were trying to get our young drivers engaged in the community. And so we reached out to this group called Project Yellow Light, which is a distracted driver awareness program. So got any listeners who are in high school or college who would like some scholarship money, they could win up to $5,000 if they could produce a 25-second PSA video, not 25 minutes, 25-second public service announcement video on the dangers of distracted driving. So we were getting our young race drivers engaged in road safety by drawing awareness, peer-to-peer mentoring of put the phone down, pay attention.
Yeah.
You know, so that was a great program that we were supporting for a number.
Amazing. So it's not active now.
No, it is. It is. Oh. Mazda is no longer involved with it. But Julie Garner, who runs Project Yellow Light, she's still very active with it and some other corporate sponsors. I'm hoping to get another motorsports sponsor to step up.
So, very cool. Well, again, there's much more I want to ask and talk about, but I do hope you'll come back for an episode 2 with us at some point.
Oh, sure.
Let's do our standard guest questions. Are you ready?
Sure.
So what is your dream car?
Oh, I'd have to say the only exotic I really still turns my head is an original Lamborghini Miura.
Oh, sweet.
Nice. Yeah.
Why does that one turn your head and none of the others do?
That was original. Like so many of the other ones are now just copies and or bad cartoons.
Yeah.
That's a good way to put it. Question number 2, where's your next road trip going to be?
Short road trip, Palm Springs on Tuesday.
Excellent.
Nice.
Very cool. And number 3, what's the most fascinating thing you've seen on the road or in someone's house or garage? Doesn't have to be a car. Doesn't.
I think seeing that Ed Justice Jr. has an airplane hanging in his office, not a model, but a real airplane hanging in the lobby of his office.
As you do.
Yeah.
Because, cool. You know, why not?
Yeah, why not? If you have the space.
Right. So our random question, the silly thing we're going to ask you today is, if If someone from the 1950s suddenly appeared in front of you, what would be the most difficult thing to explain to them about life today?
Was it the fact that we've got all the world's information on our phones and we just use it to show cat videos and argue with people?
I'm in this picture and I don't like it.
Well, I like cat videos. I just don't like the arguing. So.
Right.
I'll argue with a rock.
Awesome stuff, Dean. Thank you again for being our guest today. We'll definitely follow up with you to do a part two. And let's turn to Misty for a cultural collision. What have you got, Misty?
You're going to accuse me of doing this on purpose, and yeah. I literally did not. But I wanted to talk today about Miatas in film.
All right.
I have perfect timing, you know, yes, you because do. Yes, I'm absolutely amazing. You know, it's my favorite car, you know, I mean, I love it. And, you know, fun fact, April 2016, Mazda broke its original Guinness World Record by producing the 1 millionth MX-5, April 22nd in 2016. So who knows how many there are out there.
Right.
But I was just doing a quick run through. There's actually a website called imcdb.org, which is the IMDb for cars.
Right.
Oh.
It's actually pretty cool because
it is.
Yeah, because the Mazda MX-5 in all its various forms has been on the Teletubbies twice.
Hmm.
Once was a Monza edition. It has been on the original Sabrina the Teenage Witch. It has been in A Scanner Darkly in 2006.
Oh, interesting.
The Monza edition in the Teletubbies was actually 1997. And it was that British Racing Green, which is my second favorite.
I could see that the Tinky Winky would be in the Mazda market.
Right.
But I think the British Racing Green probably clashed with the person, well, with the Teletubby.
Yeah. Well, no, because purple does bring out green. That's why, you know, I have green eyes. I wear purple eyeshadow and purple sweaters and to make my eyes pop. So, you know, it's color theory, Dave. Come on.
That's why I do it.
See? Proud of you. And, you know, and I mean, the MX-5 has even been seen in Doctor Who. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's not a central focus like you would see like the Volkswagen Beetle, you know, or, you know, other, you know, more well-known cars. But it is just absolutely amazing. You know, it's been in Schitt's Creek. It's been in Showgirls, Sister, Sister, Saved by the Bell, Scary Movie 3. I mean, it's just it's everywhere.
MacGruber.
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 It's been in MacGyver, How I Met Your Mom, Sweet Valley High, Taking Over the Asylum. I mean, it's everywhere. It's always there and it's always in the background. And it is, you know.
So Misty, are they picking the Mazda for these background roles on purpose? Or is it just happens to be a car that they can get their hands on readily?
You know, I don't know. You know, I think, you know, personally, I'm going to go with they're picking it on purpose because it's the coolest vehicle that has ever existed with the exception of the Lotus Elise.
Well, I think one of the things that I've, you know, life-changing lesson for me from this episode already was that the idea that the Miata was actually focused on, you know, a fun sports car market that wanted reliability. So if you are trying to send, you know, if a movie is about action, sports, energy, that's kind of the brand equity of that car, as opposed to, you know, if you put like a, you know, a 72 Bonneville in the background, that's going to send an entirely different mood, set an entirely different mood.
Dean, does Mazda spend money to put the car in product placement positions?
I don't know if they do or not. That was a completely different. I was never in that department.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's funny. Sabrina, the Teenage Witch, I know where she went to high school because that is a the same high school they shot Beverly Hills 90210, which is actually Old Torrance High School, which is about 4 miles from where I'm sitting.
Nice.
But kind of the strangest movie that the Mothman actually had like more of a role, as in a used by a character in a car chase, was 1993, The Beverly Hillbillies.
Really?
Yes. Yes. And it was a silver one, which I object to because I think Miatas should be blue, red, or British Racing Green. To me, those are the only three colors that should be allowed. I have opinions in case anybody here has ever missed that.
Why shouldn't it be purple? Why can't you have a purple Miata? You could bring out your eyes.
For those because of you not is, able to see, she is twitching nervously.
Because that is an abomination unto Nuggin. And if you don't get that one, you need to go read Terry Pratchett Discworld. You know, it's just wrong.
Back around 1990, we did a color study and we painted up like 9 or 10 completely different colors. It looked like a basket of Easter eggs. And there was a teal one. There was just some wild colors.
Yeah.
And they were actually then sold to employees.
Oh wow!
I should have bought one of those because it would have been impossible to paint match years later. But
exactly.
To kind of further the really weird history of the Miata in movies, 2 years later, it was also used in a car chase in the Brady Bunch movie.
Oh, my God.
There's a car chase in the Brady Bunch?
Yeah.
Marsha got really pissed off at Jan.
Marsha had just finally had it, you know.
It's actually, if you pick who the character in that movie who's going to snap, it's always Jan.
Well, yeah, you know. So I mean, it's, you know, it's just been in, you know, the Pelican Brief, you know, the Simpsons multiple times, you know, even with the hardtop. And I'm kind of sorry, Dean, that you weren't here last week when they all talked me out of trading in my 2016 for a 2021.
Do we need to recap that for Dean real quick?
I'm still kind of sad. You know, I know that I made the right decision, but I'm still kind of sad, and I'm standing up because I want to show Dean the nice print that they sent me, as to try to convince me.
You know, right, it's one of those classic potential bait and switch kinds of things,
Where they tell me that they're going to give me like a whole bunch of money so I can actually, you know, get this brand new car for pretty much what I paid for the first one.
Right. And, which basically means just more money for them.
Yeah. But, you know, I've never have a problem walking out of an auto dealer going, yeah, this is my drive out price. And if you're not going to make it.
Right.
But yeah.
So Misty, what was the name of this website again? IMCDB, IMC.
IMCDB.org.
Got it.
You can look it up by movie, and yep, it'll tell you each and every car that was in the movie. Or you can look it up by car, and it'll tell you exactly when, you know, which episode, if it was a series.
Yeah.
And then when you click through, you know, you go and you look for the car, and it'll tell you, you know, like minor action vehicle or only used in a short scene or used by a character, you know. So if you're really interested to see how many times your favorite car has been on the silver screen and the small screen, that's exactly where you want to go. And it usually has some stills and stuff from the, you know, from the episode.
Pretty sure typing in Honda Accord is not going to give me much of a significant result. I mean, that's
you would be surprised. I mean, because honestly, I was rather surprised at, you know, the amount of times that, you know, that the Miata has been on screen, especially twice in the Teletubbies.
And think about it. If you're going to blow up a car, an Accord is a good option.
Yeah, I've thought about blowing up this one, actually.
I've got friends. Just let me know. I've got friends.
Well, I still miss my knowledge. 83 Accord. So, the 83 Accord that I used to have. Oh my God, one of the best cars ever, and I do still miss it.
Hmm. Well, now that we've done, Misty, thank you for the cultural collision, Misty. Ben, why don't you take a moment?
Yeah, well, you know, it's almost summertime. It'd be even closer to almost summertime when we release this one, and you know, what says summer more than the ice cream truck? You know, it's that humble hero of neighborhoods everywhere. You hear that little jingly music, Next thing you know, you're digging your pockets, see how many quarters you got, and you're running into the street. This is something we never grow out of, you know. No matter what age you are, we're all a big kid when we hear that thing. And I got to thinking about it, and I said, well, you know, there's a lot, you know, behind these things. It's not just ice cream. It's like it's a whole cultural phenomenon almost. I mean, you'd be surprised. I mean, even when I was, even during my, you know, my military days, I can recall we were down at the motor pool, you know, changing oil and, you know, airing up tires on our, you know, big camouflage trucks. And, you know, all these guys who were trained to kill and, you know, wearing green and, you know, we're supposed to be rough, tough soldiers. And that ice cream truck comes down the street and boom, everybody's heading for the gate. you know, absolutely. I've heard one in my neighborhood here just, you know, this year, the first time since I've been, it strikes a nerve in us all when we hear that. But, you know, what is it? Is it just a van with a cooler inside? Oh, there's so much more to it.
Oh, really? It's not just a van with a refrigerator in it?
Well, there's usually a pretty weird driver too, but.
and let us not forget the creepy soundtrack.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, yeah. the go ahead, Dave.
I was going to say the creepy soundtrack, you know, that years ago. So for Dean's benefit, the neighborhood I live in Atlanta, Dean, is called Virginia Highland, and we're equal distant from three major universities and then about equal distant from another seven others. So we have it's a lot like a college town in the middle of the city. And the vast majority of ice cream trucks I have ever heard have played that kind of heavy bass version of Turkey in the Straw. The one that drives through our neighborhood has reprogrammed all of his music. Last summer as it drove through, I swear to God, it was playing Toccata and Fugue.
Oh, what? I believe it.
Well, if he was playing the Sky version, which includes an electric guitar and drum set, now that's a cool version. Ours here in the Netherlands plays Mr. Sandman.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Now, if it played Enter Sandman, that would be something too.
That's where I was going. I was hoping somebody would bring up Metallica. That's,
well, and the comedian Stephen Wright back in the 1980s once quipped that, you know, he wanted to drive one that played Helter Skelter. but I had a friend when I was in college, or an acquaintance I knew at my university. I went to the University of Alabama, and this guy, at some point after I'd left town, I just heard what he was up to later. He had actually moved to another city so that he could drive an ice cream truck. There were none operating in Tuscaloosa. So, yeah, he actually moved up the road about an hour to a bigger city so he could get a job doing this. He did not make a career of it. He's actually now doing quite well on the West Coast. But that's proof positive that it's not necessarily a hindrance to your further career. But I looked into the history of these things a little bit. And the first one is credited to a guy named Harry Burt, I believe, in Columbus, Ohio. And Burt was also the creator of the Good Humor brand. And he had already been delivering, you know, ice cream in trucks to stores. And it occurred to him one day, why not just, you know, sell direct to the public out of the truck? But he is not the first person to sell ice cream on the street. This goes back into the 1800s when, you know, a push cart with a block of ice inside was the delivery method. And there's some dark history there, because back in those push cart days, you know, milk products were not pasteurized. And of course, being the 1800s in the United States, you know, everybody who was in business was shady on some level. So, you know, if you look it up at a lot of old, you know, sporting events and fairs and things like that, there were waves of people who got sick from this.
No kidding.
But it all came to a head kind of in the 1920s, because motor vehicle technology and electric refrigeration technology and pasteurization were all kind of becoming mainstream at the same time. Then on top of that, Prohibition kicked in. Yes. When people couldn't get a drink, a lot of them turned to ice cream.
That's hilarious.
Believe it or not, yeah. And so the ice cream truck had its moment. It was born. Harry Burt, you know, put his Good Humor on wheels, and you know, the rest, as they say, is history. You know, it's still going strong today. These trucks are running in countries all around the world. England is a particularly interesting market because they don't have as much hot weather as we do. So the profitability there is very unpredictable. But they do it. They still do it.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
No, after you.
Well, that leads me to another thing. you know, looking forward into the future. One of my heroes, I'll tell you, if we had this guy on the show, I'd be almost unable to speak. I'd be so starstruck. My hero, Ed China. He is working on a ice cream truck as we speak. Well, maybe not at this moment. Well, maybe he is. I don't know. But this is something he's doing in a series he's got on YouTube right now called The Workshop Diaries. I highly recommend it. It's a good show. If you're an Ed China fan, this is for you. Anyway, a segment he's been doing in every episode is the development of an electric ice cream van that he's going to use to set a speed record. Apparently the category for land speed record and an electric powered ice cream van is wide open. And so he's going for it. He has gotten a major supplier of the trucks in England, the leading company that converts them, to loan him one. It's a Mercedes Sprinter, and he has taken the diesel engine out of it. He's keeping the stock manual transmission. Apparently you can get a Sprinter with a manual in England. That's very nice to know. But he's keeping the stock transmission because, you know, one of the dirty little secrets of electric power in vehicles is that, you know, if you just dump the motor into a car with no gearing, you'll get just stupid, ridiculous off-the-mark acceleration, but your motor will start to run out of efficiency up at high speed. So you can build these cars that will beat a bullet off the line but top out about 80 miles an hour. But because he wants to set a speed record, he needs some top-end power. So he's keeping this big, bulky truck 5-speed to get him up to speed. And he's doing this really cool computer design thing. He's got this hand scanner that he's scanning, you know, the contours of the transmission and the electric motor and using that to CAD design, you know, the intermediate pieces he needs. And, you know, it does have a soft serve machine inside the van. This way he qualifies for the whole thing. It's got to be functional. So just imagine Ed the Gentle Giant blasting down some strip with this thing and then serving up soft serve cones at the end. I think it's going to be fabulous. I wish I could be there to see it in person.
Well, it's true, though, that the ice cream truck in general has sort of become an iconic, a cultural icon, I guess, is the way to state it. And I'm remembering the ice cream truck in Grand Theft Auto Vice City, where the mission is to sell as many drugs as you can out of the ice cream truck.
That has happened in real life too. That has happened in real life. In fact, if you look up the Glasgow ice cream wars, you'll find some info about this.
Yep.
Yeah. That's Scotland for you. Also, fun fact, do you know what Rupert Grant, who was Ron Weasley in Harry Potter, did with his fortune?
No. What did he
do? Or part of it? He bought a bloody ice cream truck and was giving out ice cream for free. He wanted to be an ice cream truck driver, so he became an ice cream truck driver.
That's fantastic.
If it makes him happy, go for it.
Yeah. Oh, and just FYI, you know, Ben, you were talking about not having as many warm days,
right?
In the Netherlands, now I can't speak for the UK because we threw them out. You know, the EU, we're like, bye. Don't let the door hit you where the good Lord split you, sweetheart. If it is above 0 degrees Celsius, we will eat ice cream.
Oh, sure. I will.
And that's pretty much the same philosophy I have with driving with the top down.
Yeah.
If it's above 0 and there is no precipitation falling from the sky, that is why the good Lord invented seat heaters.
Yeah. Oh, I'll eat it year round too.
So. I'm just still trying to wrap my head around a high speed Mr. Softy. First of all, how is he going to get that whipped quaff into a crash helmet?
All right.
Okay, there's that.
So what I want to see is the electric motor thing applied to the actual soft serve itself. Can we projectile launch it directly into a customer's mouth?
So, I'll bet we could, especially if you got into some of that railgun technology.
Ben, we want them to survive the experience.
Okay, that's first. Second, right. I'm thinking there might be liability issues. And third, y'all need to go back and look at last season in Formula One, where they have their little driver challenges, and Crofty, who is the general announcer, challenged Alex Albon to an ice cream truck race.
Nice. Okay, we'll have to check this out for sure.
So on this front, I may or may not be in possession of a t-shirt gun that may or may not have also been used to launch canned products at a Pride Parade one year. I'm not sure about ice cream. I can tell you, though, that launching cans of Spam will raise a welt.
Yeah. Well, remember them in the film,
Dean, the look on Dean's face, he's like, what have I gotten myself into?
But you remember in UHF that scene where you get to drink from the fire hose? Just yeah. apply that with a soft serve machine. Yeah. I'm sure a bunch of kids would be more than willing.
Oh, I'm sure. No, I'm sure. All right. Excellent moment, Ben. Thank you for the ice cream truck discussion.
I think actually we should have titled this segment, Ben Takes a Surreal Moment.
Yeah. But I have one question for Dave.
Yeah.
When you were launching Spam, did you even bother to include Lobster Thermidor with that?
Did not, because lobster, it has to be really tightly packed in order to survive the departure from the tube. And you know, it's like, you know, if you're putting in something loose like crab salad or lobster thermidor, so basically you're just fragging the people nearby.
I would then say that would be an appropriate response to protesters.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is still the thing about cars, despite what all my friends are talking about at the moment.
We're talking about launching things from cars.
All right, fair enough.
You know, and I'm pretty sure I could finagle a trunk mount for that on my Miata.
Oh, we have to turret. We have to make a turret for it for sure.
Yep.
All right. So let's bring ourselves back to topic here and answer our grand trivia auto question, shifting from Lobster Thermidor back to the world of cars. The question, of course, was Chrysler built a bunch of slant sixes between 1959 and 1991, but in the 60 to 62 time frame, they put 50,000 sort of unique slant sixes in Valiants and Lancers. What made that batch of slant sixes so unique? Was it because they had an electric assisted supercharger? Did they have two spark plugs per cylinder? Was it an aluminum engine block, or was it all of the above? Dean, you want to take a shot at this first?
I'm going to guess aluminum block. I'm not a Mopar guy, so I'm not really sure, but I'll guess aluminum.
Got it. Dave, what do you think?
I'm going with the aluminum block too, mostly just because Dean said it.
Misty, what about you?
I'm going to be unique. I'm going to say two plugs per cylinder.
Two plugs per cylinder. All right. Good answer. Ben, what do you think?
You know, as improbable as it would seem, I'm going to go with all of the above.
Okay.
I mean, on some levels, a lot of that just seems completely unreal for something of that time and that place and that company. But you know, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction.
That is right. That is correct. But the answer is Dean and Dave got it. It is an aluminum engine block. Turns out that the aluminum engine option at the time cost less than a radio upgrade, but it was still not popular enough to continue. So yes, thank you to Tim, I believe, for this trivia question, our trivia czar. So well done, you guys. Good call on the aluminum engine block.
That engine, by the way, you know, some people made fun of it, but it also had a really huge following. And in fact, you'd be surprised how many of them were modified for high performance.
Oh, I'm not. Yeah. I wouldn't.
And one of the great reasons for that is that an inline six is inherently one of the smoothest engine designs there is. Very, very smooth. That's why BMW leaned on them hard for so many years. But also because the block was slanted to one side, that left a lot of room next to the engine for long straight intake runners.
Right.
And so you could make the thing develop a whole lot of power with appropriately tuned intake tract on it.
So if you have a trivia question for the thing about cars, we would like you to send it to us via our Facebook page or via our website. That's thethingaboutcars.com. And if you listen to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, please rate us. Your ratings make us more searchable for people who are looking for car and automotive content. And in the meantime, what do we do? Anything else, you guys? I'm going to have to do some heavy surgery on this one.
Nikki, do you smell toast? I think you're having a stroke.
I don't smell toast. I've got to finish my taxes today. That might be the problem.
Ew.
Yeah.
I'm so glad the Netherlands makes that easy.
Well, this is the first time I'm filing jointly with my wife. This is weird. You know, we got married quite recently, so I've never had to file jointly before, which is why I'm doing it so late. So,
and now you know why I have a registered partnership in the Netherlands and not a marriage, because that's actually not recognized by the U.S. government. So according to the U.S. government, I'm still single and they cannot get insight into my non-resident alien husband's finances, because it's none yet.
So this has been the thing about international politics. Thank you for joining us.
I'm going gotta go have some ice cream now.
I didn't even mention
driving to Germany. Supposedly, I can drive to Germany from next week, maybe, possibly.
Oh, that would be good.
And you know what I'm gonna do?
What's that?
I'm gonna drive to Germany at 175 kilometers an hour, so I can have a McRib and a fried apple pie.
I think you just horrified Dean.
Oh, the humanity.
Come on. You know, it's a vice, you know, and it's not like I go every week.
Thanks for joining us, you guys. We hope you and yours stay safe out there. We'll see you with another episode in about a week.
See ya.
See ya.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.